Book of Esther. Great story in God's Word as we get into the book of Esther. Esther's a story that takes place, as we've already talked about in our study through Ezra and Nehemiah. It's a story that takes place in between the book of Ezra and the book of Nehemiah. We know that as the people were taken out of Jerusalem and led to Babylon into captivity, that just as there were three deportations from Jerusalem and from Israel to Babylon, there was also three returns, three groups of people that returned back to Jerusalem from Babylon. And so the book of Ezra, we deal with Zerubbabel leaving the first group back, and then Ezra takes another group back. And so it's between Ezra and Nehemiah that the book of Esther takes place. It's in that time where there are some that have returned back to Jerusalem, but there are many, as we saw, many that had stayed there in Babylon, which was now the kingdom of Persia, the empire of Persia. Now, in the book of Esther, we see a few main characters that are going to be kind of the story revolving around. There's going to be Ahasuerus, Esther, Mordecai, and Haman. And those are the four main characters we're going to see. And it's an incredible story. It's a story filled with romance, with sacrifice, with espionage, with suspense, irony, and twist. It's an exciting story as we get into it. I mean, if you were to go and write a script just like the book of Esther and hand it to a Hollywood producer and say, hey, this would make a great movie, they'd probably look at you and go, there's no way. This is too unrealistic. There's no way anybody's going to buy this story. And yet we see it contained as a true story here in God's Word. It's an exciting story as we begin to unravel it and look into it and begin to go through it. And so it's a story which also contains some wonderful insight into God's providence and sovereignty. Let's take a look at the first few verses. And we're going to talk a little bit, first of all, at one of these main characters, and that is Ahasuerus, who we'll see in the first few verses. Look at verse 1. Now it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus, this was the Ahasuerus who reigned over 127 provinces from India to Ethiopia. In those days when King Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan, the citadel, that in the third year of his reign, he made a feast for all his officials and servants, the powers of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of the provinces being before him. And when he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the splendor of his excellent majesty, for many days, 180 days in all. So, here we see this man Ahasuerus. He was the king of Persia, and he reigned from 486 BC to 465. So his reign was 21 years, thereabouts. And he's known and identified as King Xerxes I in secular history. So whenever you hear of and read about King Xerxes, that is this man, Ahasuerus, who will be throughout the story in the book of Esther. Xerxes is simply the Greek translation of his Persian name, which is a crazy name. It's very hard to pronounce. It's Kesharishan, something like that. It's K-H-S-H-A-Y-A-R-S-H-A-N. It's a crazy name to pronounce, and so you understand why they're going, let's translate this guy's name, because I don't want to keep trying to say that. So Xerxes was the Greek translation. Ahasuerus was the Hebrew translation of that hard to pronounce Persian name that he had there. Now, so if you hear me say Xerxes, which I'll probably say a lot of times to spare me from even saying this name, you'll know who I'm talking about. Xerxes' father was Darius, King Darius that we know of there in Daniel's time. And Xerxes will be succeeded by Artaxerxes, number one, who's mentioned in Nehemiah chapter 2. When Nehemiah goes to the king, he's the wine, remember, he's kind of like the wine taster, and he goes before the king and asks permission to go back to Jerusalem and bring some people there to rebuild the city walls, and it's Artaxerxes that gives permission to Nehemiah to go back. So Artaxerxes was the man that followed Xerxes on the throne. Now, some interesting facts about Xerxes with Ahasuerus here. He was a man known throughout history. Many historians record these things and talk about it. But he was a man that had big ideas, but he was a man with an even bigger temper. Guy with big ideas, but an even bigger temper. He was a man that went and one of his desires to go against the nation of Greece. He had built this great canal through the Isthmus of Athos for his fleet to come through. And so he thought big and he said, there's nothing going to hold me back or stop me from moving forward. He had this great canal built. Now, Herodotus, a Greek historian, and who was clearly no fan of this king because Ahasuerus wanted to come in and invade the country of Greece, by which Herodotus was a citizen of, he reported that Ahasuerus had a very bad temper. And here are two stories from history regarding Ahasuerus, King Xerxes here. Herodotus goes on to say, they then began to build bridges across the Hellespont from Abydos to that headland between Cestus and Mattitus. The Phoenicians building one of ropes made from flax, and the Egyptians building a second one out of papyrus. From Abydos to the opposite shore, it is a distance of almost 2/3 of a mile. But no sooner had the strait been bridged than a great storm came on and cut apart and scattered all their work. Xerxes flew into a rage at this point, and he commanded that the Hellespont be struck with 300 strokes of the whip, and that a pair of foot chains be thrown into the sea. It's even been said that he sent off a rank of branders along with the rest to the Hellespont. He also commanded the scourgers to speak outlandish and arrogant words. You hateful water, our master lays his judgment on you thus, for you have unjustly punished him even though he's done you no wrong. Xerxes the king will pass over you, whether you wish it or not. It is fitting that no man offer you sacrifices, for you're a muddy and salty river. This is what he commanded his men to speak to the river. So here they're building this great bridge across the Hellespont, and a storm comes up and washes it away. And Xerxes just flies into a rage. He's so upset, he tells his men, you begin to beat the water. I mean, ridiculous. Anger can do just crazy things to a person, can't it? We're in the book of Esther, and we're dealing with Ahasuerus in verse 1 to 4, Rob, and it's also known as King Xerxes. So if you hear me say Xerxes, we're dealing with Ahasuerus here. So Xerxes, a man of violence and rage, telling his men, you beat the water, and even go and throw shackles, and in a sense try to bind the water. I mean, this is what he's doing. He's so ticked off. I mean, it just, you see the violence and the fits of rage that this man had. And also, in these ways, he commanded that the sea be punished, and also that the heads be severed from all those who directed the bridging of the Hellespont. So all those that were a part of the building of that bridge, he said, behead them. They're gone. It was just a storm that came up. So this is the kind of guy that we're dealing with. Oh, there's one more story too. Let me not stop there. A father's request here. As Xerxes is marching out with the army, Pythias the Lydian, this is, again, Herodotus that's sharing this in some of his historical writings. Pythias the Lydian, dreading the heavenly omen and encouraged by the gifts given to him by Xerxes, came up to Xerxes and said, Master, I wish to ask a favor of you, which would be a small favor for you to render, but would be a great favor for me to receive. Xerxes, thinking that he knew everything Pythias could ask for, answered that he would grant the favor and asked him to proclaim what it was he wished. Master, it happens that I have 5 sons, and they all are bound to soldier for you against the Greeks. This is when he's going up against the Greeks once again. And so this man says, I pray you, king, that you have pity on one who has reached my age, and that you set free one of my sons, even the oldest, from your army, so that he may provide for me and my possessions. Take the other 4 with you, and may you return having accomplished all you intended. Well, Xerxes flew into a horrible rage and replied, you villainous man, you have the effrontery, seeing me marching with my army against the Greeks, with my sons and brothers and relatives and friends, to remind me of your son, you, my slave, who should rather come with me, you and your entire household, including your wife. You may now be certain of this, that since the spirit lives in a man's ears, hearing good words, it fills the body with delight. When it hears the opposite, it swells up. When you at one time performed well and promised more, you had no reason to boast that you outperformed your king in benefits. And now that you have turned most shameless, you shall receive less than what you deserve. You and 4 of your sons are saved because of your hospitality. But one of your sons, the one you most desire to hold your arms around, will lose his life. Having answered thus, he commanded those charged to accomplish this, to find the eldest of Pythias' sons, the one that he was asking to return home with him, find the eldest of his sons, and cut him in half. and having cut him in two, to set one half of his corpse on the right side of the road and the other on the left side, and between these, the army moved forth. So Xerxes, having one request, and you got five of my sons, can you just let one return home, says, how dare you ask such a question? Let's cut that one in half, and we're going to march right in between his corpses. This is the kind of guy that we're dealing with, and so we see quite clearly that he's a guy that you don't want to mess with. He's a guy you don't want to cross, which makes the story in Esther so intriguing, as Esther literally risks her life to go into the king's court, as we will find out as we go through this, to save her people, the Jews. That's what the story of Esther is all about. Now, a few things that's interesting about this book of Esther is that there's no mention of God. You will not see the name of God mentioned at all in the book of Esther. You will not see anything about prayer. It's really quite an unreligious book. There's not a lot of mention about no mention about sacrifices or anything like that. And it could be very well linked to the fact that, again, here are the people that are getting very content and complacent staying back in the land of Babylon or Persia. And fellow Jews are going back to Jerusalem. They're seeing God moving in great ways. But these people were those that had begun to get very comfortable there when they were still having the Babylonian kings rule over them in Babylon. Things were a little bit more harsher. But the Persian rulers want to really kind of appease and make them comfortable, and feeling that if they, are being kind to them, then they're going to be kind back. They're not going to revolt or turn. And so the Jews were beginning to see that life can be pretty comfortable here. They were establishing businesses, having good homes there. And many people were being very complacent and content. And so it's interesting that it's in that time here that we see that God's no longer mentioned. God's not named by name. And what we could consider as a book void of God, yet we actually see his design, his divine presence and providence all the way through it. It's very interesting. The word providence comes from the words pro and video. Pro meaning before, and video meaning to see. In other words, as we talk about God's providence, it's that he sees all and he knows all. From the beginning to the end, from the end back to the beginning, he sees all, knows all, and he is in control of all. The prevailing of his will in all situations is what we would refer to as God's providence. And it's interesting, there are a number of examples in Scripture that detail God's providence, that detail God's interacting and moving and working through different events that we would otherwise look at and go, oh man, God is so absent from this. You look at the life of Joseph. And you see how he's sold by his brothers, he's betrayed, he's thrown into a pit, he gets picked out of the pit, sold into slavery in Egypt, ends up in Potiphar's home. And all these things, right in that in itself, you'd think, God, what have you done to this man? You just let him be? How could you let this happen? He was the guy you gave dreams to, that he was going to be someone important, and now he's in Potiphar's house in Egypt? And we could think, God, how come you're absent? And yet, God's going, wait a second, who said that I was absent from this? I am guiding and I am leading and I am directing by my providential hand here. I am at work in all these things. He would later get falsely accused and sent into prison. And there he would tell the dreams to the baker and the butler, was it? The candlestick maker, whoever it was. And tells the dreams, and one of them is killed, and the other one says, oh, Joseph, don't forget about me. The other guy gets released, and he forgets about Joseph for 2 years. Joseph could have been thinking, why are you, God, what's going on here? But again, it was all according to God's timeline at just the right time. When Pharaoh would have a dream that no one could answer, suddenly this man remembers, well, it's not just coincidence, this is God's timing here, God's providence at work here. And Joseph gets free. We see the similar accounts in Scripture with Moses as he's put in a baby basket and he set sail. And the basket just happens to float down the river right when Pharaoh's daughter is there bathing in the river or at the riverside. Oh, and she discovers Moses. What a coincidence. No, it's God's providence. Jonah gets thrown over the boat, and he's left to drown in the sea at just that right time. Big fish comes up with a, man of an appetite here and takes him down, and God's providence, you know. Saul and David. David's out hiding in a cave, and just at that moment, Saul goes, man, I gotta go relieve myself. He has to go to the bathroom. He goes into the cave that David is hiding out in. And it gives David an opportunity to take off a piece of his robe and approve his loyalty and faith in that situation. God leading and directing, and at work at times where we think he's left us, he's failed us. And you see, it's in this situation, the story here, in these different events that we're going to see, and Esther becomes a story full of lessons of God's providence moving everything along to accomplish his purposes. It's in those times that we can think, God, you've left us, but it's God actually working behind the scenes. And though God is not mentioned in the book of Esther, we know that he is at work. And we know that he is accomplishing his purposes. Alexander McLaren writes, this book of Esther does not say much about God, but his presence broods over it all and is the real spring that moves the movers that are seen. It is all a lesson of how works out his purposes through men that seem themselves to be working out theirs. God is working on his purposes through men that seem to be working out their own purposes. God is at work. And it's a wonderful illustration and story and example for us here. Now, Esther's name means star. In the exhaustive dictionary of Bible names, it also has this as a definition for Esther. Not just star, but also that which is hidden. Interesting. See, in the work of God and the hand of God is indeed hidden all through the book of Esther. His guiding presence is seen hidden in the story, but even greater than that, God's very name is hidden throughout this story and throughout Scripture here. The name Yahweh, interestingly enough, appears in acrostic form 4 times in the book of Esther. Now, acrostic, again, is making a word out of the first letter of a series of words. You look at, you know, NATO, for example. It's the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. I had our youth group in Linden, and our youth group now, because it fits, Clay, Calvary, Langley, Youth, you know? Acrostic, that's what an acrostic is. And all 4 of these acrostics that identify the letters Yahweh appear in 4 consecutive words. And so we see it happen in Esther chapter 1, verse 20. It's not going to mean anything much to you to look at that verse now, because, of course, we don't see it unless we're looking at the Hebrew. It's seen in Esther chapter 1, verse 20, in Esther 5, verse 4, in Esther 5, verse 13, and in Esther 7, verse 7. And also, there's a few other acrostics in the book of Esther, which identify, again, God at work. There's the name that he gave in Exodus chapter 3 to Moses at the burning bush, I am, that I am. That appears in Esther chapter 7, verse 5 in acrostic. We also see the name Messiah and Yeshua appear in acrostic. And so there's also some Hebrew manuscripts that have those letters for Yahweh in bigger letters, so they stand out when you're looking at the text. And as you're reading along, they stand out and kind of jump out at you, and you identify very clearly, here's the name of God. God at work in the book of Esther. Though things might seem hidden, the very name Esther, meaning that which is hidden, though things might seem hidden. And though at times we might feel that, you know, God, where are you? God, you seem so far from me. You seem so absent. What? I'm in a situation here. And yet we can always take comfort that God is present with us. He'll never leave us nor forsake us. And at times where we don't always see it, he is working behind the scenes, doing an even greater work, fulfilling even his purposes.
Amen.
Isn't that wonderful? Can I share I should have phoned you ahead of time, but can I share the story of what has happened with Holly and Clint? You know, it's interesting because, you know, Carla and Ron have been praying so much for their daughter, you know, and wondering, Lord, what are you doing through all this? And it's been a very trying time, no doubt. Well, you know, Holly decided to come back home and leave a very bad situation that she was in, and had met up with a friend that the friend decided to accompany her back to the camp's house. And they both came to church on Sunday. And was it Sunday or Monday that Clint was talking with Enoch? And Clint gave his life to the Lord last night. And so we see these events happening that at the time you look and you go, Lord, where are you? Where How? What are you doing here? And yet, in his timing, he's doing an even greater work than we could have ever have perceived and thought of. So it's exciting to see what God does. And so Esther is certainly a book that reminds us of his faithfulness and his working behind the scenes. Though he might seem hidden at times, he's never far from us. And his hand is never off of the situation. He's in control, working it all out. We have to keep our trust and faith in him and in him alone. So, let's pick it up now again in chapter 1. What's the time right now, guys? Anybody, can you tell me the time?
Quarter after 8.
About that? Okay.
7:38.
All right.
There's an 8 in there.
There is an 8 in there. Okay. So, we've looked a little further about the book of Esther. We've looked at what a ruthless kind of king that we're dealing with, that Esther is going to have some interesting correspondence and interaction with. Let's look at verse 5. And when these days were completed, he's got all of his people there. Now, what's interesting, again, let me stop there, because we've seen him gathering all these officials and leaders and powers of Persian media, all the nobles, they're all coming together, the princes of the provinces coming together, and he's having a huge feast now for 180 days, 6 months, he's having this great feast. Now, historians tell us that this feast and gathering of the people was a desire to form a coalition to fight against the rising empire of Greece. There had never been at this point an empire like Persia. It was incredible, but Greece was on the rise. And interestingly enough, Darius, Xerxes' father, had already attempted to go against Greece. He had conquered many nations and was really moving forward. But he went up against Greece in 490 BC and suffered a shameful defeat by them. And so Darius and the nation of Persia was unable to advance against Greece. And so here's Ahasuerus now, Xerxes. He's motivated by revenge of this loss and to avenge his father. So he's seeking to show off his kingdom in an attempt to impress people to continue to follow him, to form this coalition with him to go against the nation of Greece. And so we see this, it's happening over 6 months. And what's interesting is here he's showing off his vast empire and all the goods that they have. You know, what's exciting is that, you know, Jesus, it tells us in Ephesians chapter 2, verse 7, that Jesus is going to be showing and revealing to us the riches of his grace in the ages to come. You know, I think for all of eternity, he's going to continue to just unravel more of the picture of all that he's done for us. And grace and his love and forgiveness is just going to be... is he's going to grow in understanding for us. It says in the ages to come, he's going to show us the riches of his grace that he had toward us. That's exciting, isn't it? These guys are taking 6 months, and we can think, oh man, what are you going to do for 6 months? But for all of eternity, I believe we're going to be seeing and understanding in a more greater way the riches of his grace. How exciting that is, isn't it? Well, verse 5 now, when these days were completed, the king made a feast lasting 7 days for all the people who were present in Shushan, the citadel, from great to small, in the court of the garden of the king's palace. There were white and blue linen curtains. These were the royal colors of the Persians. White and blue linen curtains fastened with cords of fine linen and purple on silver rods and marble pillars, and the couches were of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of alabaster, turquoise, and white and black marble. And they served drinks in golden vessels, each vessel being different from the other. And so that's probably a reference to the fact that great riches, they had vessels of all different sorts. You know, in my house, vessels of all different sorts means that we're just kind of got things from all over the place, that we don't have a lot of money, we're just kidding, whatever we'll take, right? These guys here, they have all different sorts, and they had just a great assortment of all these things. And so just again, showing the riches and the wealth in the kingdom. And with royal wine in abundance, according to the generosity of the king. And so the wine was flowing quite freely here at these feasts that they were holding. Now, in accordance with the law, the drinking was not compulsory. For so the king had ordered all the officers of his household that they should do according to each man's pleasure. Now, typically, the guests were required to have a drink whenever the king would hold his cup up. whenever he'd hold the cup up, they would all have a drink, you know. Well, here he says, you just do what you want. You drink when you want and as much as you want. The wine is flowing freely, but they could do according to each man's pleasure. And Queen Vashti also made a feast for the women in the royal palace, which belonged to King Ahasuerus. And on the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine. Now, after 7 days, you can imagine that these guys are going to be wasted, all right, you know. 7 days of drinking wine, flowing freely. I can't, maybe I've had a little bit too much. I can't even speak properly. That's terrible. I shouldn't say that. sorry.
Well, you're not recording anyway, sir.
That's going to be edited out. Don't worry. I've had nothing else so far. Okay. On the seventh day, when the heart of the king is merry, so they're no doubt drunk now, 7 days. He commanded Mahuman, Bista, Harbona, Bigtha, Abagtha, Zether, and Carcass. Now that guy's really wasted. He's just a carcass now. He's just laying down. He's out cold, man. Seven eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus to bring Queen Vashti before the king, wearing her royal crown in order to show her beauty to the people and the officials, for she was beautiful to behold. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command brought by his eunuchs. Therefore the king was furious and his anger burned within him. So here we see now three things that are quickly going to bring a man down. Pride, drunkenness, and anger. All these things characteristic of King Ahasuerus. He was a man that was full of pride. See, it's believed that at this point when they're all, you know, sitting together and they're drinking, that there was a debate that began to take place, you know, which country, which province has the most beautiful women? And of course, Ahasuerus is going, oh man, I've got you all beat here. You should see my bride, Queen Vashti. She is beautiful. And it's thought that when he says that he ordered her to come out wearing the official crown, that is all that he wanted her to be wearing as she came out. And so it's as though he just wanted to parade her out as some trophy and show off her beauty before all the people. And so we see a man full of pride, drunk, making unwise choices that are dishonoring to not only himself and others, but of course to God. And we see him, again, flying into a rage, okay, uncontrolled by this anger. It's interesting that the king was a master of a great empire, but wasn't able to master himself. Wasn't able to keep control of himself. Proverbs chapter 16, verse 32 says, "He who is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he who rules his spirit than he who takes the city." Hey, the one that's mighty, the one that can take a city, good on you. But the one that is slow to anger and is able to rule his own spirit, better is he. That's what the Proverbs say, very wise, very true. His pride got the better of him. His drunkenness caused him to lose control, and his anger caused him to be blinded by rage. And it was pride that was feeding anger, and anger is going to be that which will reinforce pride. Proverbs chapter 14, verse 17 says, "A quick-tempered man acts foolishly, and a man of wicked intentions is hated." A quick-tempered man acts foolishly. And Ahasuerus is certainly, you know, giving some credibility to that verse. He is a man that is quick-tempered, and he's acting foolishly. You know, the Bible never says that wine is wrong. But it tells us over and over again that drunkenness is wrong. And I'll tell you this much, you know. I mean, wine is one of those things that so quickly can cause a person to lose control, you know. It's kind of like opening up that can of worms. It's something that you want to be playing with, you know. And so here we see every example, it seems, that we talk about, you know, drinking in Scripture. There's always kind of a bad connotation associated with it. And this is a great example of that right here. Is they're drinking, and they are just acting in the flesh and doing wrong. And so the king then in verse 13 said to the wise men, who understood the times, "For this was the king's manner toward all who knew law and justice. Those closest to him being Karshina, Sether, Admatha, Tarshish, Meres, Marsena, and Memucan, the seven princes of Persia, and Media, who had access to the king's presence and who ranked highest in the kingdom. What shall we do to Queen Vashti according to law? Because she did not obey the command of King Ahasuerus brought to her by the eunuchs. And Memucan answered before the king and the princes, Queen Vashti has not only wronged the king, but also all the princes, and all the people who are in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. For the queen's behavior will become known to all women, so that they will despise their husbands in their eyes when they report King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought in before him, but she did not come. This very day the noble ladies of Persian Media will say to all the king's officials that they have heard of the behavior of the queen. Thus there will be excessive contempt and wrath. If it pleases the king, let a royal decree go out from him, and let it be recorded in the laws of the Persians and the Medes, so that it will not be altered, that Vashti shall come no more before King Ahasuerus, and let the king give a royal position to another who is better than she. So all these men here are saying to Ahasuerus, you got to do something about this. You got to put her away, because if other ladies catch wind of this, then they're all going to go, oh, well, if Queen Vashti can stand up to the king, then we can surely stand up to our own husbands. And this would be the start of the woman's lib, you know. It's going to take place, you know, a few thousand years earlier than it has, you know. And there's going to be a big uprising. We've got to bring a stop to this, you know. And so they're pleading with the king. And it says in verse 20, when the king's decree, which he will make, is proclaimed throughout all his empire, for it is great, all wives will honor their husbands, both great and small. So when the king would make a decree, that decree was binding. It could not be altered. It could not be changed. And so this decree was made. And here in verse 20 again is that first acrostic where we see the letters YHWH, the proper name of God for Yahweh or Jehovah. And so it's in this time. And every time that we see those four acrostics pop up in the book of Esther, it's kind of at an interesting point. It's at a point where there's sort of a shift or a change kind of taking place. And again, it's in those times where we can think things are changing, shifting, that, oh no, what's going to happen now? That again, we see God right in the midst of it, working behind the scenes, in control, and working out his purposes. Guys, we never have to fret or fear. We never have to worry when things seem bleak or things are changing and we don't have the solution or the answers. We have to trust in God and know that he is in control and working behind it all. Even when we may not hear or see, he's at work. And here he is, Yahweh, being seen in this verse, at work when his decree is going forth. And the reply pleased the king and the princes, and the king did according to the word of Memucan. Then he sent letters to all the king's provinces, to each province in its own script, and to every people in their own language, that each man should be master in his own house and speak in the language of his own people. And so it's at the event of kind of putting Queen Vashti away now, where she stands up, and again, God ordained that she stood up there. And God is using those events to bring in now this next character, the person of Esther, who God is going to use mightily before the king. Look at chapter 2. After these things, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus subsided, he remembered Vashti, what she'd done, and what had been decreed against her. After these things now, there's a four-year span that takes place between chapters 1 and 2. You'll see that as we get down a little bit. In verse 16, you'll see that it's in the seventh year of his reign. And in the beginning of the book, it was in the third year that the feast had started. So 4 years taking place between chapters 1 and chapters 2. And it's in this time that Ahasuerus went to fight against Greece. We talked about his desire to go up against Greece. He went up against them, but he too, just as his father Darius was shamefully defeated and came home now a bitter man. He's upset. And so it says it's after these things that he remembered Vashti. It's at this time that he remembers what Vashti had done, and he seeks now to fill that void and emptiness by selecting a replacement. He's thinking and longing and trying to satisfy the desires of his heart and the emptiness by, again, fleshly ways. Then the king's servant, look at verse 2, the king's servants who attended him said, let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather all the beautiful young virgins to Shushan, the citadel, into the women's quarters, under the custody of Haggai, the king's eunuch, custodian of the woman, and let beauty preparations be given them. Then the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti. This thing pleased the king, and he did so. So here they're going to hold basically like a Miss Persia pageant. They're going to have all these women come, and you know they'll have the bathing suit contest, the question, the evening gown, walk out. They're going to do all this stuff, and they're going to parade the woman out, and the king is going to have his choice now over who he wants to replace Queen Vashti. Look at verse 5. In Shushan, the citadel, was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish of Benjamin. Kish had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captives who had been captured with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. And Mordecai had brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, that's Esther's real name, or her Jewish name, her Hebrew name, Hadassah. And it was Mordecai's uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman was lovely and beautiful. When her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So Esther grew up as Hadassah. Her mom and dad passed away. And Mordecai takes her in. They're cousins. He takes her in and he raises her. She's an orphan girl. Mordecai raises her as his own daughter. So it was when the king's command and decree were heard, and when many young women were gathered at Shushan the citadel under the custody of Haggai, that Esther also was taken to the king's palace into the care of Haggai, the custodian of the woman. So it's believed that, you know, this isn't something that Mordecai pushed her into, or that she was, you know, just voluntarily going. Is that the idea is that she was taken, that it was kind of against her will. But again, here's God acting and intervening now to bring about his purposes in bringing her into the king's palace here. Now in verse 9, the young woman pleased him, and she obtained his favor. So he readily gave beauty preparations to her besides her allowance. So this is speaking of Haggai. Esther was one that pleased Haggai. He was the one that was over the king's woman here, taking care of them. He was in custody of them. And Esther began to live a life that was very favorable, and it just really kind of won over Haggai, and he was very pleased by her. She obtained favor. And so he was kind of, you know, doing extra things for her, giving her extra beauty preparations and allowance. Then at the end, in the second part of verse 9, then seven choice maidservants were provided for her from the king's palace. And he moved her and her maidservants to the best place in the house of the woman. Esther had not revealed her. So here she is now, even having maidservants given to her, seven of them, to care for her. I mean, she's really, it reminds you of Joseph, doesn't it? Put in an unfavorable situation, yet God blessing through it. That's what's happening with Esther here. Esther had not revealed her people or family, for Mordecai had charged her not to reveal it. So again, they were Jews. And Mordecai, it's believed, has probably changed her name to Esther, a more of a Persian name, and so that her name Hadassah would not give her away as being a Hebrew girl. He says, don't tell anybody that you're a Hebrew. He's not telling her to lie, just saying, don't say anything. She's going to later on reveal her identity in the book of Esther. But he's just saying, don't give away your identity. If they don't ask, don't tell, right? And of course, that's going to help her in this situation, which is kind of gaining favor all the more. And every day, Mordecai paced in front of the court of the woman's quarters to learn of Esther's welfare and what was happening to her. Each young woman's turn came to go into King Ahasuerus after she had completed 12 months preparation according to the regulations for the woman. For thus were the days of the preparation apportioned: 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 months with perfumes and preparations for a beautifying woman. So apparently they went and gathered women from all the farmlands, and these were people working out in the fields. 6 months with oil of myrrh, and you know, they're getting out the sanders on the nails, you know, grinding down the toenails and all. They're really doing these girls. These were, I guess, hardworking girls. I don't know. So, no offense to any farmers out there. All right. Thus prepared, each young woman went to the king, and she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the woman's quarters to the king's palace. In the evening she went, and in the morning she returned to the second house of the woman, to the custody of Shashgaz, the king's eunuch, who kept the concubines. She would not go into the king again unless the king delighted in her and called for her by name. So each woman was called, and they would go in and they would spend a night with the king. And they would be told to go the next morning and return back. And basically, that was their chance. One night with the king. Some of them, that was all they had. And they were forced to live as that concubine, basically living as a widow the rest of their lives. Most of them would never ever even see the king again after that. They'd be forced to live as a widow there unless the king had remembered. The girl had kind of won the king over. If he remembered her, he would call for her again. But most of the time, kind of one night, and they'd go and live with the harem, with the concubine, and that was it, living as a widow the rest of their days. Now, verse 15, when the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his daughter, to go into the king, she requested nothing but what Haggai, the king's eunuch, the custodian of the woman, advised. So here's Haggai telling her, hey, you know what, take this with you, put this on, this is going to really give you favor with the king. Again, just seeing God's hand and God at work in bringing favor for her. And Esther, it says, obtained favor in the sight of all who saw her. So Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. The king loved Esther more than all the other women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins. So he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king made a great feast, the feast of Esther, for all his officials and servants, and he proclaimed a holiday in the provinces and gave gifts according to the generosity of a king. So here we see Esther now brought in, receiving and obtaining favor by the king, no doubt by God's provident leading here. God's providence at work, working behind the scenes, bringing all these things together to accomplish his purposes. And we'll see exactly what those purposes entailed as we continue to move through the book in the coming weeks here. But look at verse 19. When virgins were gathered together a second time, Mordecai sat within the king's gate. So now it seems that the king is gathering new people, more people now to come and come before him. It's not as though he finds Esther and says, that's it, I found my soulmate. I mean, there were still people that he would be entertaining. And Esther, notice Mordecai sat within the king's gate. So he too was in a position now, in an official position. Whether or not that's through Esther kind of granting him that place, speaking to the king, or whether Mordecai lived in a way that just, you know, he had attained that kind of favor as well. But he's in the king's gate. It is a place that they would kind of hold court and take care of different affairs. So he's there in an official position. And in verse 20, Esther had not revealed her family and her people, just as Mordecai had charged her. For Esther obeyed the command of Mordecai as when she was brought up by him. And in those days, while Mordecai sat within the king's gate, two of the king's eunuchs, Bigthan and Teresh, doorkeepers, became furious and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. So the matter became known to Mordecai. Now, we're not sure what they got upset about. Maybe it was that Queen Vashti was put, maybe they were Vashti fans and they were not happy about her being replaced. We're not sure exactly, but something got a bee in their bonnet, and they got really ticked off at the king here. But Mordecai hears about it. Again, Mordecai, just by coincidence, happens to be in the right... No, it's not by coincidence. God having Mordecai in the perfect place, the perfect time. God's at work here. So the matter became known to Mordecai, who told Queen Esther, and Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. And when an inquiry was made into the matter, it was confirmed. And both of these guys were hanged on a gallows. And it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. They were hanged on the gallows. That's thought to be what they would do here. Hanged on the gallows is they would take a sharp kind of pole, you know, and they would place the person on it and basically just, you know, gorge him on this pole. And they would just hang there on that and eventually die. Of course, it's a very painful, excruciating death. It's kind of, you know, where crucifixion sort of had come from. So they were hanged on the gallows. Not that they were, you know, with a rope around the neck and hanged. They were impaled on this stake. Very gruesome. So here's what happened to them as the word goes forth. But now we're going to see something here. In chapter 3, verse 1, after these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman. Interesting. Promoted Haman. What about Mordecai? Mordecai just let you in, King, on a conspiracy against you. He just saved your life, basically. What about Mordecai? Why are you promoting Haman now? Well, again, next time we get into the book of Esther, we're going to stop right there. But we'll see here, you know, we have one or two options in those situations. We can get upset and ticked off and think, hey, I've been wrongly used here or unjustified. What's going on here? I'm the guy that should be promoted. We can sit there and get upset and bitter about those things. Or we can say, well, God, I look forward to see what you will do through this. Because God has perfect timing. Our timing would be, hey, I gave the facts. I revealed the story, the conspiracy. I'm the guy that should get promoted and promoted now. That's our timing. But it's not always God's timing, is it? Because God, again, in his providence, knows the beginning from the end from the beginning. He knows what needs to work out to ultimately bring about his perfect plan. And to bring about God's perfect plan, this man Haman needed to first come onto the scene. God's not going to forget about Mordecai. We don't have to worry and fear. If we're ever in Mordecai's shoes, we don't have to freak out and try to, you know, push forward or try to justify ourselves. We have to take the side that says, Lord, I'm just going to put my faith and trust in you and believe that you'll work out an even better plan than I foresee. And God will do that. The book of Esther shows us that he will. So we'll continue on in that story in a couple weeks.